Funkar det här?
Hallå?
Ja. Okay. Hello everybody. So, in the 8th lecture in the series of NIS lectures 2013, it's a pleasure to see that we are still just about filling the auditorium, and also it's a pleasure to welcome 30 persons or so who are following us online. So it's nice to see that the concept is setting down as a regularly meeting place for folks interested in information security in Gjøvik and Norway in general. Today, it's a pleasure to introduce Frode Hommedal, who from the Norwegian, no, always say this wrong in English, National Security Authority, better known as NSM in Norway, who will give us a brief talk, 45 minutes, on threat perception. So please, Frode, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Should we lower the lights a bit? Or is this... How do I do that? Like this? Okay. Yeah. Nice and intimate. Yeah, you already commented on this slide, so but I'll just say a little bit about what I'm doing, well, on a normal work day. I've been in NorCert. How many of you know what NorCert is, by the way? Good. Only a few people need whipping. I work in what's called the analysis team, and I work mostly with targeted threats, and which basically translates to espionage. And one of the things that I have come to realize over the last couple of years is that, or how difficult it is to communicate vulnerabilities and threats when it comes to the use of modern ICT systems. So this has sort of become a favorite topic of mine, talking about the threats to these systems. And just recently, threat perception. Because not only is the threats hard to understand, they're also hard to perceive. And so this lecture is kind of a mixed bag between talking about the threat, it's the threats themselves, and also how we perceive them, or perhaps how we don't. And just to sort of to blow it all away in the second slide, this is going to be my main message. Our brains are not wired to understand cyber threats. Right now, competitive advantage is being gained by a lot of countries and organizations through the use of espionage. And understanding the threat and how what it is and how it operates is basically key to survival, in my opinion. So here we go. This is the first slide. Threat perception. And our reptile brains immediately recognizes this as a threat, I'm sure. I mean, if this wasn't a picture but a bear in front of you, you would be in no doubt that you were in immediate danger, I guess. Doesn't really look all that nice. I don't know if you see that up there, but he has like really killer eyes. I wonder what happened to the photographer. That as well, and a broken tooth. He's been fighting before. Also this. For those of you who have seen this movie, the woman he is looking at is in absolute... she is in no doubt whether or not she is in immediate danger. So, to just try to scope it a little bit, what I'm going to talk about, actually I told you this already, but threat can be many things. It can be Jack Nicholson with an axe, it can be a raging bear, but the threats I'm going to talk about is threats, and this is important, it's an important distinction, it's threats posed by human threat actors to ICT systems, and the information, yeah, well, you can read. Because there is a lot of confusion about the terms when it comes to security and threats and so on. Security is also operational security, I mean mean time before failure on hard drives, but I'm just going to talk about the threats where the threat is being imposed on you by someone else and by a human somewhere. Also, I'm just going to postulate this. Cyber espionage is rampant, even industrialized, period. This is a separate lecture. I mean, to try to come to this conclusion is a separate lecture, but it is the conclusion that at least I have come to after working with this for 7 years. And it's the conclusion that basically anyone has come to who's been working with this. So even you, I guess. I mean, you study IT security, don't you? So, okay, new title slide. And I'm sorry I'm using the cyber word, but it's here to stick, so I'm just going to embrace it. So I'm going to talk about threat perception in cyberspace. And I yeah, well, I don't know what cyberspace is, except I do. It's like one of these things that if you know a bit about it, you sort of know what it is, but if someone asks you to define it, not so sure. This is Merriam-Webster, the online world of computer networks and especially the internet. Well, it's cute. To also try to just make a brief definition of cybersecurity, again, Merriam-Webster, measures taken to protect a computer or computer systems and so forth. The key point here, of course, is measure. I'm going to come back to that. This is just something that I drew on the train coming up here. I know, it's awesome. These are sort of the main security concepts, if you will, at least when it comes to national security, and especially if you read the Security Act that my organization is working by. These are kind of like the four major categories of security that we try to sort of group everything into or something. I don't know exactly what cybersecurity is, but I know in the intersection between these four types of security, well, at least that is cybersecurity. That and, of course, a lot of other things, but that is somewhere to grow our understanding of cybersecurity. See, I should have put this slide. Pretend that we go from here about measures to here. Because I'm going to talk a little bit about risk soon. But before I do that, I just want to say security is basically about risk management. Does anyone here disagree, by the way? This is just something... No, good. I see people shaking their heads. But this, to me, this is sort of key, because I've met so many security professionals who don't know the first thing about risk management, nor about risk management processes, how to estimate risk in any way. Just, no, I do security. No, you do risk reduction work. No, I work at security. To me, security and risk management is like closely tied. How many of you have seen this representation of risk before? Okay, good. This is called the risk triangle. Well, if I translate it from Norwegian, risikotrekanten. This is the sort of model that NSM is using when we do risk assessments. And the reason for that is that if you want to handle risks that comes from threats posed by threat actors, it is hard to start to making what's sannsynlighet in English? I totally forgot. Probability, yes. It's hard to assign probability to the intentions of threat actors. So you sort of have to tackle your risk assessment in a different way than trying to predict the probability for something happening. And this method basically tells you to, well, that is for all risk assessment, identify your assets, identify the vulnerabilities these assets have, and also identify your threats, or should I say the as complete set as possible of realistic threats, and then see if damages these threats can do to your vulnerable values is something that you cannot live with. And if you cannot accept a scenario like that, you have to sort of go in and manage that risk by putting in place barriers and stuff like that. Very dry and blah blah. But to be honest, I think this is almost the same as Sun Tzu said 2,500 years ago. I mean, the key to victory is knowing yourself and knowing your enemy. And if you don't, you're gonna lose. That is what this is all about. These two edges is knowing yourself, and this is knowing knowing your enemy. And if you don't know both, you're gonna lose, basically. So, in my opinion, Sun Tzu was awesome at risk analysis. Back to threats. I said I was going to talk about threats as being imposed on you by an actor. And there are, at least at the national security level, but also at the at the corporate level, I'd say these are kind of the three threats that you need to account for. It's terrorism, it's sabotage, and it's espionage. These are the most, should I say, these represent the most dangerous threat actors. You do, of course, have other threat actors. You have LulzSec, for instance, but they're like two kids in a basement, while espionage is a building in, well, should I say Shanghai? Yeah, I'm going to do it. So I'm going to focus on the espionage bit. So back to cyber threat. Oxford says malicious attempt to damage or disrupt, and totally forgot steal and exfiltrate. I'd say the most important cyber threat that you have to sort of be aware of is espionage. And this is nothing new. I mean, you have read this probably many times before. But I wonder how many of you have an acute sense of what espionage is, and that is one of the things that I'll talk about later. But first I want to sort of go into the word threat, because I showed you the picture of the bear, and it was an obvious threat. And the way we... this is, again, just a definition of threat. There is intention in there, there is danger, there is harm. But I found something interesting about perceived threat, which is a bit different. And I think the clear and present danger to me and mine is sort of key here, whether or not something is going to scare you. This is obvious. Here you cry for help, you run, and you fear for your life. There is espionage going on in there right now, I'm sure. I'm not very scared. Don't even care. It's actually a very nice photo. It's so, yeah. It's easy on the eye. So why is that? Why don't we perceive this threat as clear? It says here that clear, among other things, means free from obscurity and ambiguity. Okay, so here's a slide you're probably going to read, so maybe I should give you a second instead of talking while you read. Well, I'm a slow reader, and even I read this now, so I suppose you're done. If there is anything you can say about cyber threats, at least after working with it for a while, is that freedom of obscurity and ambiguity is not properties of cyber threats. How many of you know the word tradecraft? Good. Not sure I do. It's like cyber. I know it, but I can't define it. It means how you do stuff, and especially in the clandestine services, I mean how you lose a tail, how you If you've seen the Osama bin Laden movie, he was standing under a tree, never looking up because the satellites wasn't supposed to see him, and someone said, oh, that's good tradecraft. People conducting espionage in cyberspace are awesome at tradecraft, and they will throw as much obscurity and ambiguity your way as they can, and they can throw a lot of that at you. They can pretend to be someone else, they can stage their attack through chains of proxies, jumping through satellites that you can't trace back. I mean, there is so much that a threat actor conducting espionage in cyberspace can do that will obscure your view of what's going on. And also, the last one there is actually from a different presentation I have. And it's... My key point in that presentation was that one of the reasons vulnerabilities and threats is so hard to communicate when it comes to cyber threats or ICT systems is that there are so many layers of abstractions going on in technology. I mean, say programming language, object orientation. I mean, it's just layer upon layer upon layer with abstractions, and most people only use the topmost abstraction level to interface with technology. And I mean, people really love iPads. Well, at least non-geeks love iPads. Maybe even geeks love iPads, I don't know. You put them in your arm and you sort of stroke them. It's like a little baby. You stroke them and they do stuff for you. I mean, that's the level of interaction with the technology. Then how are you going to see through all those layers of abstraction and figure out what an attacker could do to identify and exploit vulnerabilities? Most people don't have a chance. So, the problem with cyber threats is that it doesn't appear to be a clear and present danger. Not to our reptile brains. I mean, it doesn't have fangs or bad breath or roars at you. And also, even if you sort of get past that, it's still so complicated to grasp that it's like, well, don't understand it, so I'm not scared. How many of you, well, I'm going to first ask a really dumb question. How many of you have heard about Bruce Schneier? Oh, it wasn't as dumb as I feared. Okay. You should know about Bruce Schneier. He has written an excellent book. First, the book that brought me, many. He wrote the book that brought me into security, Applied Cryptography. But recently he wrote a book called Liars and Outliers, which is kind of a cross... Tverrfaglig? Cross-discipline, thank you. Cross-discipline book about security. And one of his key, one of the things that he talks about is society's need for trust, people's need for trust. I mean, and how we trust. And he used, like, in the beginning, absurd examples like you sit in an auditorium like this without fearing that anyone will stab you in the back. And of course we do, but when you start thinking about it, yeah, we actually do. And I stand like this. And a bus of how many tons comes roaring past me in 80, like this from me. I just trust that he's going to follow the road and just pass me. So trust is something that we just absolutely need to live without anxiety. And when when you don't trust someone, or you don't trust the system or yourself for that matter, that is a very uncomfortable feeling. And this picture is so soothing. And it's so nice to use the cloud services and stroke your iPad. We just so much want to trust our computer systems because it's convenient. It is so integrated into everything we do that if we started mistrusting our computer systems, it would be like mistrusting society as a totality in a way. And that is just not something most people want to do. It is much easier to just downplay cyber threats as it's just a virus. It's just some hackers, and you imagine some hooded Eastern European guy living in Ukraine working for the mafia or something, instead of thinking of it as big organizations doing industrialized espionage. and hacking computer systems all over. About that, I mean, who read the paper today? That's what I mean by industrialized. So, I've been talking a lot about intelligence and espionage. How many of you think you really have a good grasp of what it is? I mean, everyone knows basically what it is at a very like shallow level, but how many here think they have good insight into what intelligence is? One person. Cool. Yeah? Good? I'm glad. Until a couple of years ago, I did not.
I don't know what military intelligence is.
I'm going to tell that to my friends in the military intelligence. But yeah. Until a couple of years ago, I got my image of intelligence from movies and fiction novels, as I guess most people, or at least most people who are as lazy as me, who don't read a lot of books, or faglitteratur. See, my English is terrible. Just literature, okay. Ah, instead of fictional literature, okay. So I didn't know a lot. So it was a steep learning curve. But I think I'm slowly getting a grasp of it. And to be honest, it scares me. I'm not quite at the bear yet, but I'm getting there. So at a very basic level, I mean, intelligence is just like security, a term that can mean just about anything based on who you ask or the context it's been used in. But you can say that intelligence is an activity, often thought about as spying or surveillance or something like that. But most intelligence organizations in the world have a very, very structured way of producing their intelligence. And this structured way of producing intelligence, of course, spawns a lot of activity, like intelligence gathering or information or data collection. For example, from Angela Merkel's phone. It's a method, intelligence analysis. Google it and you'll get a bunch of articles about how to do good at intelligence analysis. For instance, structured analysis of competing hypotheses. Very close to just doing good scientific work, but applied to intelligence. Intelligence is also a product. Someone can come with a report to you and say, here's our best intelligence on whatever, bam. And you can also think of it, or it is a function, like the Norwegian Intelligence Service, NSA, CIA, GCHQ. They are all national intelligence services serving as just that, the national intelligence service, a function in the state, providing intelligence for the government. This is about the motive, and this was sort of, it's so obvious, but to me it was still a revelation. Why do people actually go through all this work to create good intelligence? Well, it is to gain advantage. And this is something that everyone does all the time. I mean, we just don't call it gather intelligence, but we do, right? We collect information, we assess it, and we use it to, well, gain advantage in every aspect of life, basically. Oops, unintentional. But you don't call it intelligence. For it to be called intelligence, you usually need an intelligence organization of some size. And all states have intelligence services. You have a lot of, not in Norway, but in other countries, you have a lot of state-sponsored intelligence services, but who are private. And you have a lot of private intelligence services. Normally they are not called intelligence services, they are called analysis bureaus or whatever. Have some of you heard of RAND Corporation, for instance? Yeah, again the professor. You should listen to this guy. So there are a lot of agencies or organizations in the world who basically provides intelligence to corporate customers, but they don't call it intelligence. And there are, if you're going to just zoom out really far, I tend to say there are two, well, if you exclude military intelligence, there are two kinds of two types of intelligence. It's strategic intelligence and industrial espionage. Strategic intelligence is about long-term advantage. That is about negotiation positions in the WTO negotiations, for instance. You need good strategic intelligence to sort of go into those negotiations and do good for your country, right? Or at the corporate level, you need good strategic intelligence to sort of know where you're going to navigate in the marketplace and be successful. And strategic intelligence as a concept is something that you can do without doing anything illegal. I mean, you should do this. This is just beslutningsstøtte. Decision support, yeah. Strategic intelligence is basically whatever you, well, is an activity you do for decision support. Right. Uh-huh. See, I'm being schooled by the professor. Good. And then you have industrial espionage, which is, I mean, of course, these are not the only two, but it's the based on my experience, this is what you see most. And industrial espionage is whatever you do to either steal technology to gain advantage or get to know about some contract negotiations to get advantage or anything you can do to gain advantage over competitors as corporations. And there are a lot of actors doing this. Of course you have state actors doing strategic intelligence for governments. That goes without saying. I mean, that's why you have huge government organizations doing intelligence in the first place. But you also have state actors conducting industrial espionage for their national industry. And unfortunately, this is not as... thank you. Uncommon, as you'd hope. There is a big fear in Norway to say names, but I could obviously name a lot of countries doing this, and everyone knows it. But since I'm here in official affairs, I'm not going to. To be honest, it would surprise me. But what do I know? The point is... There is public evidence that that might have happened. The point is, this is not uncommon at all. Then you have corporate actors doing the same thing, either doing strategic intelligence or industrial espionage on behalf of the government. In some countries, you have huge companies being contracted by the government to do this, for instance. In other countries, you have volunteer groups doing this, sort of on unofficial behalf. The point is, there are a lot of private groups doing this, either with approval or with written approval or silent approval of doing it. And then you have, of course, corporations or security companies, they call themselves for some reason, doing the same kind of intelligence work for private companies. And who of you have read the Hangover report from Snorre Fagerland at Norman? No. You should Google that, because that is actually an excellent report on exactly this. Where a Norwegian company also was hit. And this is just something that I'm pulling out of thin air because I haven't really seen it. But now I'm assuming, which I guess I shouldn't, but I'm doing it. I guess that out there, some big corporation is just doing this for themselves, doing it in-house or unofficially with, I don't know, hacker friends or something. Good. Okay, so that was a bit about what intelligence is, who is doing it and why, and the profiles of the different actors. Now I want to talk a little bit about the intelligence process, or the intelligence cycle, as it's also been called. And if you Google that, you'll get as many different kinds of cycles and processes as you do Google searches. But they are in many ways very similar, no matter how they're representing their model. At the very essence of the intelligence process is what is here called the planning phase. You could also call it the management phase. This is where someone comes to an intelligence agency and says, hey, you see, I have some questions for you. I really would like to know this, this, and this. Can you help me figure that out? And someone says, sure, we can prioritize this. Or they say, no chance, you're not a high priority customer or user of ours. And when you sort of get a mission and you say, yes, we can prioritize this, you make a plan of how you're going to conduct it. And then you go over, when you have a good plan, you go over to the collection phase. And we have been talking about cyber threats. And the collection method that we observe when we have computer incidents, and it is espionage, is the threat actor's collection phase, where they have decided to use network operations, as it's sometimes called, or cyber espionage, or hacking, God forbid. But they have a lot of other means. Big intelligence organizations can do signals intelligence and just listening in on the traffic that goes. They can do open source analysis. They can, pull down an amazing amount of information that is publicly available that will help them reach or answer the information requirement. You can put intelligence operators in the field and do what's called HUMINT. And there are just a vast array of methods for collection. I'm talking about the cyber espionage hacking actions. Oh, I used hacking and cyber in the same sentence. I wouldn't have a Norwegian, but these are the only word. I'm falling back on bad habits in English. So when you've done that, you have to analyze what you've pulled in. And you put together some kind of report where you and piece together something, maybe an assessment, that will answer the information requirement. And then you go back to the customer and say, here you go. This should answer at least some of your questions. So there is a whole thing going on behind the scenes behind computer incidents or security incidents that you tag as espionage. So I want to go back and talk about perception again and perception about security incidents. And I've already said something about it. So when you have a security incident, it may not just be a virus. That's what you hear. Oh, we had a virus on a computer. But no, you didn't. If it's espionage, and often it is, you didn't have a virus on your computer. You had a foreign intelligence operative on your computer collecting information that goes back into this huge process of analyzing and assessing and reporting on what they found. Yeah, well, basically what I just said. one of the really surprising things, I mean, I'm sort of hoping this comes as a surprise to you, because it, not going to swear, it sure did for me. But in surprisingly many incidents that I've been involved in handling, the people, and we basically just handle incidents that are of some severity, and that often means it's espionage in one form or the other. And so we go to this company that has had an incident, and we say, well, this is highly likely espionage. And they go, but why? We don't have anything we can imagine anyone else would be interested in. And I don't really understand how they came to that conclusion, but this is the reality. Surprisingly many have come to that conclusion that we don't have anything that anyone else is interested in. If you're being targeted in an espionage campaign, your opponent definitely thinks you have something of interest. And that should sort of be a wake-up call. But it isn't, because most people don't really sort of get what espionage is. Also, if you're targeted in what you can assume is espionage, it's not like banking Trojans. It's not something you just get. If you get this, you are targeted. I mean, these are people sitting 24/7, in many cases, working with huge backlogs, and they're not going to spend their resources on you if you are not a prioritized target. Because if you're not, they're going to use the resources somewhere else, because they have a huge list of, well, users or customers, whatever you want to call it, who is constantly asking for help to resolve some kind of, well, to get questions answered, because they are in some kind of competition with someone somewhere where they need information to get the advantage in that competition. So these operators doing espionage is not going to waste their resources on you unless you're a prioritized target. That is also something that very seldom sinks in, at least until you've had a few severe espionage incidents in your company. Because when you have a cyber espionage incident, it means that somewhere out there have sort of tagged you as the competition, or as part, or you represented it in some way, or you can stuff the opponent, the people conducting the espionage, think can help them. How shall I put this? I keep saying the opponent, but that is also a very unclear term. The opponent in this case, then I mean the intelligence organization, but of course your competitor is the customer of the intelligence organization. So I see here that I've been a bit vague. It's the customer of the intelligence organizations who have tagged you as a competitor. And they have gone to the intelligence organization and said, hey, can you help us gain advantage over those guys by stealing this stuff? That is what your cyber incident or cybersecurity incident means. It does not mean that you have a virus on a computer. Yeah. So, still not very scary. It's still this whole complex of cyber threats and cybersecurity and espionage is, even when you get into it pretty deep, as I am at this point in time, doesn't really keep me awake at night. I know it's dangerous, but my reptile brain isn't really scared. But it's looking more like this. It doesn't scare me, but I know it can kill me. And that is, I guess that is as far as I can hope to sort of bring other people. Not scared for death, not scared for their lives, but at least realizing that this is a much, intellectually accepting that this is a much larger threat than it seems Well, I should have that server picture again, because that doesn't seem scary at all. This is okay, I know it could kill me, but yeah. For the record, it was a panda because it was cute, not because it's Chinese. And that was it. And we have 5 minutes for questions, or more.
So there's a mic.
You mentioned that you or your team only deal with cases that are escalated to a certain level.
Yeah.
And but how would the escalation process be? Does it come through the, say, the operations center at Norsat, or yeah, will it come through private actors, other companies, or I know Norsat has a number you can call. Do you guys have a number you can call, or how do you get the cases?
The analysis team, which I'm a part of, is sort of a support unit to the Norsat operations center, in addition to having a lot of other areas we work with. But one of them is to do incident response support. So it so when someone has a has an incident and they call NORCERT, it goes to the operations center, and based on the triage there, we might sort of get pulled into the process. But the incident as such is handled by the operations center. We're just assisting on cases where it's believed to be espionage. Does that answer your question? Sort of.
If I would show you a picture of a forest, yeah, would you be afraid?
No.
But there is an animal, a bear, running around in that forest that makes you afraid. If you show me a picture of a server, I'm not afraid, but I know that there could be some virus or whatever you want to call it running around in that. That makes me afraid.
Yeah.
Isn't it an unfair comparison that you have? On the one hand, you show a dangerous animal. In the other case, you just show the environment where the danger is living.
That is a very good point. And also, it is sort of... I'm a bit envious. I should have had that comparison myself. Because the... I'm going to use it from now on, if it's okay. Because the problem with this kind of espionage and computer systems is that we can't really visualize what is happening in there. We can sort of only visualize the computer, and it doesn't scare us. We can't see what's going on inside there.
No, but if I would show you a list of code, everybody, well, maybe not the people here, but everybody in normal life would get afraid, even if it would be some innocent piece of code.
Not sure. I think you would just ignore it. but I think you're sort of touching upon one of the most important points about threat perception. This threat is so remote from us that we can't relate it to anything physical. So our three-year-old monkey brains can't really process it. Did I say 3 or 3 million? Right, okay. I meant 3 million.
Thank you very much. Very interesting presentation. One of the areas that we do research on here at HEEG is risk perception and risk presentation and information rhetorics and how you present security to managers, etc. So we have a course in information technology rhetorics, which I can highly recommend.
Yeah, I should attend that course.
One of the things I didn't see in this, which was interesting to me from what we teach, is social engineering. And not getting into the concept of deception and inception. Most of the times a good spy will spy on you, you don't even know.
Sure.
And then the next issue is something called naive mental models. Have you ever gone into...
No. Okay. But the reason I didn't go into specific methods is because that would, well, that would be the next hour.
Okay, but the point is, if you don't have the right mental model, you won't perceive, and that's what you've been getting into, is the first you have the mental model, and that affects the perception. And that's what the research is indicating.
Well, please send me links. I'd like to read it.
Thank you.
we have time for another question or two if I'll run around.
So, since we're hunting for examples to engage the reptile brain, well, one of my pet areas is the security of electrical power networks. Mm-hmm. And talking about pandas, for no other reason than they look cute, we know that there have been, especially for the U.S. power grid, there have been incursions into various command and control systems there. Now, the purpose of that is the placement of backdoors, of Trojans, of collecting intelligence. But you kind of wonder what would a state-sponsored actor want to do with detailed information on where the circuit breakers are for substations somewhere in the U.S. Midwest?
I don't know. I can speculate, but anyone can speculate. Fortunately for you, I love to speculate. And to me, this is obvious. I guess it shouldn't be, but because when you think something is obvious, you don't investigate and find surprising answers. But I'm gonna do that leap of foolishness, not faith, and say I think it's obvious, and that is. Military strategists predict that the next big confrontation between modern civilizations is going to be, or modern countries is going to have a heavy influx of computer network attacks. So how do you do that? Well, you kill off, you control physical things and shut them down. So if you want to and unlike a stockpile of rockets that you can produce and you can store and you can get out for later use when you need them, if you want to be able to shut down the U.S. power grid or anyone's power grid, you just have to constantly stay in there. You cannot stockpile that kind of... I guess that was the answer you were looking for. you cannot stockpile this. So you just have to constantly be there. So you have to sort of figure out, okay, what do I want to do in a conflict and with which countries? And you just have to start undermining it and sort of install kill switches in a way. And to do this, you need continuous intelligence continuous espionage and continuous foothold, because equipment is going to get switched, technology is going to be upgraded, and yeah. So you... I'm guessing that some countries around the world have teams dedicated to just have the capability to turn off some other countries, say, power grid. No? Contingency planning. It's capability stockpiling. Oh yeah, absolutely. There are just a couple of countries that I can imagine Norway going, well, not going to war against, but being invaded by in the future, by physical closeness. And based on the cyber capacities of some of them, I'm pretty sure they're here.
On that, I think it's a good point to round off. Yeah. Thank you to Frode for for answering the question and for a nice presentation, bridging the gap between the human, the corporations and nation states, and for giving the threat a face, right? Thank
yeah,
you so much.
Giving threat a face. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your attention. Yeah.